CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hey, you're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoff. Thanks for tuning in. This is edition 328. And on the broadcast this week, I am going to be speaking with Alexander Avina, who is an associate professor of Latin American history in the School of Historical, Philosophical, and Religious Studies at Arizona State University. He is a widely published writer and authored Specters of Revolution, Peasant Guerrillas in the Cold War Mexican Countryside, which was published by Oxford Press. Look it up. I wanted to speak with Miguel because I thought that he could provide an important insight to thinking through the dynamics in Latin America today as part of a series of conversations I recorded for this program, Free City Radio. And I talked to him about understanding the left trajectory of the interrelationship between progressive movements in Canada and the United States and across Latin America. I think there's often this colonial and also neo-colonial line drawn at the U.S.-Mexico border that understands a dynamic of political relation as one that is unequal. It's a cultural reality that undermines in many ways the massive contributions to progressive thinking in the Americas that have really played a critical role in directing and pushing forward progressive movements across the hemisphere, including, of course, also in Canada and in the United States. So we talk about recent events in Latin America and thinking about progressive movements today in regards to challenges of the contemporary imperialism of the Trump administration. But we also go back to the 1980s and talk about the sustaining impact that the travels of thousands of activists who went down to participate in the defense of popular movements and progressive movements in Central America who were facing the brunt of the violence of the Reagan administration in the context of the Cold War, the ways that those experiences had a profound impact on progressive movements in the United States and Canada. It's a very meaningful conversation, and I'm really happy to share my exchange with Alex Avina on this week's edition of Free City Radio. Here it is. Alex, the context right now is we see this reference point consistently in the media, which is an interesting one, and I think it's a touch point, let's say, historically, which is this sort of reemergence of the Monroe Doctrine. However, it sort of like links a historical period of U.S. territorial expansionism and overt colonialism with what's happening under the Trump administration. And I'm sure that you can speak to this, not see continuity between what's happening now and previous administrations more recently in a historical sense is important, whether it's, you know, Clinton as Secretary of State being involved in intervention-style politics in Honduras, or, you know, the sort of consistent battering of, you know, progressive governments in Latin America. So I thought that maybe that's an interesting point to start, is sort of trying to think through this moment not as totally isolated. Of course, I'm not. It's important to recognize difference in policy. We have this overt military intervention, but there's also connection points. And so maybe we could just start on that. And if you could just start also by introducing yourself. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me. My name is Alex Avina. I'm an associate professor of history at Arizona State University. I think that's the question you laid out is the kind of like the big one that some of us more historically minded writers and scholars have been grappling with, how to make sense of the so-called Monroe Doctrine, right? And it's always dangerous to do historical analogies, right? It's never a one-to-one, but there's, as you mentioned, there's obviously historical continuities. And we've seen everything has a history, right? So this particular Monroe Doctrine has its own particular history. So one place we could start is by thinking about U.S. policy toward Latin America after the Spanish-American War in 1898. And that's really the historical referent for the Trump administration. So that period from, let's say, 1898, 1899, after the U.S. wins this, what one U.S. official called a splendid little war against Spain, the U.S. gets its first extracontinental colonies in the form of Puerto Rico and the Philippine Islands and that also Guam. And then it nominally gives sovereignty to an independent Cuba, but Cuba will be under, will not have much economic or political sovereignty vis-a-vis the United States for decades. And from the end of that war till about the Franklin Delano Roosevelt administration, it's the era of gunboat diplomacy in Latin America. And we see something like 34 to 35 overt U.S. military interventions in Latin America. It's always with the U.S. Marines, and it's generally to protect U.S. business interests. If anyone wants to read like a quick little pithy summary of this, check out Smedley Butler's War as a Racket, because Smedley Butler was a 2-time Medal of Honor winner in the U.S. Marine Corps. He was involved in a lot of these U.S. military interventions in Mexico and Haiti, where he got his Medal of Honors. And then by the end of his career, he realizes that he was just a gangster for capitalism, as he put it. And also that period was a very overt, direct interventionist relationship that the U.S. forged with Latin America. And definitely by Trump's people first referring to their politics in the region as the Trump corollary, they're referring to the Roosevelt corollary, which is Theodore Roosevelt's addition to the Monroe Doctrine that he put into place in the early 1900s that made the U.S. an international police force in the region. But as you're mentioning, right, there's more recent developments that kind of get thrown into this approach that the Trump administration is using toward Latin America. And the way I understand the current moment is to think about how the war on drugs, the war on terror, and the war on migrants come together to form part of this Don Road Doctrine. And now it's very explicit. Like, I think the war on migrants, as we're witnessing in the U.S., the Trump administration has had to change tack because of popular resistance. So now we don't have these huge campaigns like we saw in Minneapolis, because essentially the people in Minneapolis chased them out, which is very, for me, very inspirational and heartening to see. So now they're focusing on the war on drugs. And as we saw recently with the Shield of the Americas meeting in South Florida, they're going to use the war on drugs as a way to violate Latin American sovereignty and to extend political and economic control over the region. And right now they have the help of about 10 to 12, you know, blacky right-wing governments in Latin America that will allow them to, house and U.S. military personnel in their countries to wage a so-called war on drugs, which in the end, these are not war on drugs. These are war on poor people and a way to extend U.S. empire.
A lot to unpack there. Thank you for sharing those points. I think about the really important book that came out maybe about a decade ago, Drug War Capitalism by Don Paley, which I think is an interesting reference point to sort of decoding some of what you were talking about. So for people hearing this, that's just a reference. I'm thinking about sort of trying to understand a little bit more sort of the context that you're talking about and sort of developing an understanding of the war on drugs as a tool of political, economic, and military power. So maybe I'll just leave it there. If you could just talk about that a little bit more for people who are hearing this, and maybe this is kind of a new idea for them.
Yeah. No, Dawn Paley, she's a good comrade. That's a great book recommendation, Drug War Capitalism. I would also, folks want to check out Osvaldo Zavala's book, The Cartels Do Not Exist, is another also provocative reinterpretation of what the war on drug means in the Mexican case, whereas Don's book gives us Colombia and Mexico. So this militarized approach to drug interdiction, where you essentially wage war on the supply of drugs, didn't become like a global approach to it until after World War II. And the U.S. government is really the force behind trying to spread this approach to illicit drugs. And it matches up with the beginning of the Cold War. So throughout the Cold War in Latin America, then one way that the U.S. will seek to intervene in not just Latin American politics, but also Southeast Asian politics, is to use the war on drugs as a justifying framework to get involved in internal political strife and social developments in Latin American countries, but also as a way to kind of geopolitically arrange how they are, the U.S. government presents its view of the world to an American populace. So that they'll use the illicit drug issue as a way to castigate governments that they seem, that they deem to be antithetical to U.S. imperial goals. So for instance, in the 1950s, there's a lot in the press, the U.S. press, about how Red China is trying to poison the Americans with their dope. And not to make a profit, but also to politically and socially weaken the United States from within. And after the Cuban Revolution, they'll do the same thing to the Cubans. Even though the Cuban Revolution under the July 26th movement, they actually got rid of illicit drug trafficking. Before the revolution, Cuba was the transcontinental hub of drug trafficking in Latin America. The revolutionaries take over and these traffickers scatter throughout the region to do what they did. But in the U.S. press, then revolutionary Cuba becomes kind of like the main drug trafficker of the region. We see this repeated in the 1970s with Salvador Allende in Chile, and then we see this in the 80s with the Sandinista government in Nicaragua. In the 80s, they will start to combine the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the Sandinistas, and other left-wing movements, and they'll say they are all moving drugs into the United States under the control and auspices of the Kremlin. All the while, the actual states that are involved in illicit trafficking, they're all allies of the United States, right? So they're allies in Southeast Asia during the Vietnam War. There's a lot of stuff written about that, especially by like Alfred McCoy. They're using Cuban exiles to do a lot of CIA secret operations in the region. A lot of these guys are involved in illicit drug trafficking. And in the infamous cases in the 1980s are the Nicaraguan Contras, right, with the Iran-Contra scandal. The CIA is obviously working and tolerating illicit drug trafficking being conducted by supporters of the Nicaraguan counter-revolutionary forces called the Contras, who are moving drugs into the United States to use that revenue to fund the counter-revolutionary struggle against the Sandinista government in the 1980s. And then once you get rid of the Cold War and the Soviet Union falls in 1990, you still need a justifying framework for U.S. empire. And the war on drugs becomes the main way to justify how the U.S. government will deal with Latin America. They had already hinted at this in the 80s. In the 80s, where you start to develop the concept of narco-terrorism, which is like it's so important today to understand what the U.S. is doing in Latin America. The concept of narco-terrorism emerges in U.S. government circles and neocon intellectual circles in the mid-1980s. And so they were already preparing for a unipolar moment. Like, how do we justify U.S. foreign policy and U.S. empire after the fall of the Soviet Union? And the war on drugs in the 1990s becomes one way to do so. And if you read Don Paley's book, right, the first iteration of how they apply this war on drugs model as both a political and a developmental form is Plan Colombia in Colombia in the late 90s and early 2000s, where the U.S. pours billions of dollars into so-called counter-narcotics operations in Colombia, but as we now know, it had a very deeply counter-insurgent core in which they were using to hit at both the guerrilla left in Colombia, but in the electoral left as well.
There's been a lot of interesting and meaningful discussion about critical of U.S. foreign policy, particularly in the last months after the military intervention and attack on Venezuela. Important. One thing, though, and I think you might connect with this point, that I find is often missing, even from progressive discussion, is what's happening at a grassroots level. We get into a lot of discussion about political leaders, sort of very simplistic shapes about, you know, politics as only taking place as a top-down process. You mentioned this sort of historical arc, and earlier you had mentioned people power in Minneapolis, right? And I just want to underline that point, Alex. What you said was so important about trying to understand and also just acknowledge that popular mobilization in Minneapolis changed the course of ICE policy in the United States today in 2026. Thinking about popular movements, going back to the 80s, and you mentioned Central America, I was talking to a friend yesterday about that, who had spent some time in that region during this time. And one thing I think that often, you know, and it speaks to this question of people power, often gets removed because it's kind of the inverse, is how deeply movements in Central America actually impacted and shaped the left in Canada and the United States. I mean, we can talk about, you know, somebody like Bernie Sanders, you know, who's very well known, who was part of those delegations, but it was thousands of people, right? But at the base, that was like a popular movement that actually really had a huge impact on popular understanding of progressive politics. So I just wanted to leave some space to these are just two reference points, but just to sort of think through and talk about that point of centering popular organizing, not just, you know, symbolic political leadership, and why that's important today in the face of Trump administration policies.
Yeah, I mean, I think just to say quickly a couple of things of Minneapolis. Minneapolis is also the epicenter of the Black Lives Matter movement 2020, right? And it was one of the places that really radicalized and pushed that movement forward in really meaningful ways. And if we even stretch it back, it's one of the epicenters of the American Indian movement as well in the late 60s, early 70s. So that city, I mean, to understand these popular mobilizations, we have to go back in time. I mean, it's unsurprising that I'm saying this as a historian, but like, I'm just saying that there's trajectories and memories of rebellion and popular mobilization in a place like Minneapolis that we need to pay attention to. And you're exactly right. We can't just focus on the high politics, but we have to focus on the grassroots low politics and how those interface with the high. You can't have the high without the low, essentially. Yeah, and this is a really important matter to think about when trying to understand what's going on in Latin America today in relation to U.S. empire. So one instance that I can think of, and then I'll get back to your point about the 80s, because I think it's a really important one, is, you know, there's a lot of discussion in like progressive or even left circles of whether the current political leadership of Venezuela has sold out to the United States or has, you know, surrendered or betrayed the legacies of the Bolivarian Revolution. And one of the things that annoys me about people who are pushing that line, other than the fact that they don't have enough information to even be making that kind of judgment, but whatever, we'll put that aside, is that it ignores the grassroots, right? It ignores the very people who made someone like Hugo Chavez possible, right? Like and we don't hear from them a lot, right? Particularly in mainstream media. Like, we don't hear about what the comunas are doing. We're not hearing both in the cities and in the rural sectors. We don't know about how they're mobilizing and organizing and thinking about both what their current political leadership is doing and how they're identifying what the United States is doing to them. And we have a similar dynamic with what's going on in Cuba as well, right? Like, I think the U.S. is currently strangling Cuba in a horrific, you know, it's a horrific slow form of violence, right? That is just tolerated. It's an obvious violation of international law, if that thing even still exists. But it's really difficult to get access to what people on the ground in Cuba are think about this process, think about what they're experiencing. There's some exceptions that I've read recently, particularly like there's people on the ground in Cuba, like working with Belly of the Beast and some other like more local media organizations. But that they get left out of the story, right? And if we leave them out of the story, then we fail to understand really the essence, the core of some of these societies, particularly those that tried to reorganize themselves in revolutionary ways, whether it was Cuba beginning in the late 1950s or Venezuela since the late 90s, early 2000s, right? So, yeah, I would, and sometimes I understand some people, even on like the progressive or left side, will kind of shy away from that, because once you start to look at the grassroots, you're gonna discover a lot of internal contradictions, right? But that's what we need, right? That's what we need, because again, if we are supporting these people, we have to embrace and inhabit those internal contradictions while also keeping in mind that there's a scale to power in this situation. And obviously at the very top of the scale is U.S. empire waging this particular form of violence, right? So I think we need to keep that in mind. In terms of the 80s, I wish we had more, and I hope people, we do have some good stuff, but I want more historians and scholars to focus on exactly that period that you mentioned, 1980s, and the Central American Solidarity Movement, because the Central American Solidarity Movement in the U.S. and Canada and how it interfaced with the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, with the FMLN, and with refugees in general did have a huge impact on the left in Canada and the United States, right? So the sanctuary movement in the U.S., the sanctuary movement for migrants and refugees begins with actually not too far from here, from me, like a couple hours south of here in Phoenix and Tucson, by Presbyterian ministers who decided to organize an underground railroad for Central American refugees who were fleeing homelands wrecked by death squad regimes that were fully financed, armed, and military supported by the U.S., but were not allowed to come into the U.S. They were not allowed to claim refugee status in the U.S. for geopolitical reasons. So you had religious figures here in the U.S. organize an underground railroad that helped refugees and asylum seekers come into the country. You also had hundreds of thousands of Americans and Canadians go to a place like Nicaragua and do literacy campaigns, do health care campaigns. Sometimes it was just enough for them to put their bodies on the line and actually go physically occupy places where the Contras were attacking civilian populations, and that reduced Contra attacks against civilian populations. The political and the intellectual impact of this movement, like, is still, I mean, we still feel it today. The historian that made me want to be a historian, my mentor, she came out of that movement. She worked as a young person, went to Nicaragua in the 1980s and worked in a literacy campaign. And then she came back and became a university professor. Like, so there's the long-term intellectual and political impact of these people, of these solidarity movements in the U.S. and Canada, we're still experiencing it to this very day. And it connects to the present migrant rights movement, to the refugee movement. So it's extremely important. And I don't know how much of an impact that movement had on like U.S. politics. I would argue that it did. There's a reason why the Reagan administration had to do a lot of blatantly secret illegal things. And some of it had to do with grassroots pressure on their elected representatives, who then went to Congress and forbade the Reagan administration from openly supporting the Contras, right? Which then led them to do a lot of illegal shit. And as now that it's all part of what we now know as the Iran-Contra scandal. So that movement, the Central American Solidarity Movement in the 80s, I would say we need to learn more from, because it offers a potentially really productive model for us today.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that, Alex. Just that's maybe a window for people to think about, and just like underlining a few of the points that you mentioned about the fact that there was this flow of ideas and people at quite a grassroots level in different sectors of people that were deeply influenced by that moment in Central America, and I think it also points to this idea that power, of course, you talked about the sort of structural dynamics at play with U.S. imperial power at the top. But it is an interesting way for us to sort of flip how we understand power. Like in the United States context, like let's say, for example, the way that Brazil has dealt with Bolsonaro is definitely something to learn from if we're thinking about, dynamics at play with right-wing authoritarian figures. So I guess maybe my last question would just be, obviously that, U.S. interventionism right now in the Americas is killing people, murdering people. And just to state that, it's gotten a lot of attention, but I guess I would just ask your thoughts about the importance of listening to and learning from the movements on the ground there and sort of flipping that script in terms of power dynamics, and why that thinking through that is really important right now.
I mean, one thing we have to discard, and I don't think it exists as much on the popular level as it does at the high political level within Canada and the United States, is we have to discard almost a structural racism that exists when we think about Latin America and the Caribbean, as if intellectual production and political knowledge can only happen from a north-south direction, but it can actually happen from a south-north. And actually, history bears that out, right? If folks want to check out Greg Grandin's newest work on America, he shows the long history of how both the United States and Latin America have been intertwined in all sorts of ways for centuries. But he also really shows how there is, particularly during the Cold War, there was some really dynamic intellectual and political currents that developed in Latin America that then came to the U.S. and influenced political movements in the U.S. So in the immediate sense, we have to discard this. I mean, I jokingly refer to it as like the sepia filter approach, where like as soon as you cross the U.S.-Mexico border and you're in Mexico, like in those movies, right, everything gets yellow. It's that sepia tone and there's danger and you're in it. It's almost like we have to discard this civilizational border that people in power in the U.S. and Canada have erected between us and the people of Latin America. So I think that's the first step, that we have a lot to learn from movements, from history, from politics in Latin America that we could then apply to better our situation here in the United States and in Canada. And if we pay attention to the grassroots who have made and organize and given life to some of the most important political movements of the 20th and 21st centuries in Latin America, and I would say globally, we're going to learn that fundamentally that we have power. If we organize and if we aggregate our physical presence, our political presence, we have power in where there's more of us, right? Like that's the one fundamental lesson of Latin American popular movements. There are as many more of us than them. The question is, how do we organize and deploy our demographic superiority in a form of political power? And part of to do that also, I love this phrase that the Zapatistas, the EZLN in Chiapas has, where they say, you know, a people with a memory is a people, is a rebel people. So in other words, like, which is probably like a horrible direct translation because I'm thinking about it in Spanish. But the idea is like, if you know your history, a particular form of history, then you're rebellious because you know that things in the present don't have to be this way. They're this way for a reason. They're this way for a reason that benefits a tiny elite at the very top at the expense of the many. So having some sort of historical consciousness is really important that will allow them to develop some sort of like class and racialized consciousness that can lead to more radical grassroots politics akin to what we've witnessed in Latin America for over a century. So that's the one. And I think in the it's really hard, at least I'll speak for the United States context, it's hard to push this kind of, to get folks to accept this. There are certain communities that do, right? We witness Minneapolis. I think at the local level, we do have a lot of really interesting dynamic organizing that's happened around the issue of ICE and Border Patrol and migrant rights. The question for the U.S. is how to scale that up to a national level beyond just like the municipality or the regional level, but how do we get this into a national movement? And that's been the struggle for the last 2-3 decades since the anti-war movement against the Iraq war. And this is, I mean, right now we have to figure out why there is no broad-based organizing against the Iran war, against the U.S. extrajudicial execution of more than 100 people in the Caribbean and the Eastern Pacific, what they did to Venezuela, et cetera, et cetera. Part of the reason why is because we're living in an incipient fascist society, and we saw what happened to Palestine protesters over the, you know, over the course of 2023 and 2024. I mean, I still know students who are still going through some sort of legal process because they tried to set up an encampment on my own university campus in the spring of 2024. So there is like a very, I think, not to say that people are scared, but there are impediments to organizing at the national level right now in the United States. But at the local level and at the city level, we've seen some really dynamic models like in Minneapolis that hopefully could become something we learn from for the national level.
Right on. Thanks, Alex, for the conversation today. I really appreciate it.
No worries, Stefan. This is awesome. Thank you. I'm glad we finally were able to make it happen.
That was a conversation with Alexander Avina, who is a historian and professor. I encourage you to look up his work, and thank you, Alex, for being on the program this week. Free City Radio airs weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m., on CGLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Thursdays at 8 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. and Fridays at 1:30 p.m., on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m., on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m., on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m., on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m., on CGSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Tuesdays at 4 p.m., and on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. We're also a podcast. Look us up. Just search Free City Radio. And you can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I'll speak to you next week.